deep sigh, and Inkette turned away. "Rest well, brother," he said. "I'll be back from Kaitian when the war is done. The guards will inform me when the necessary changes have taken place in you." He started to leave, then paused and glanced at Najiri. "You may think this no kindness, but at least the boy will be a willing first victim." With that, the Prince of Gujara walked away, gesturing for all the guards, even the ones who'd caged them, to follow. The children hooded the reaper and coaxed it to its feet. It shuffled away between them, docile for the moment. "An Inkette," Ehuru whispered. He did not know if it was a curse or a plea. If an Inkette heard, he gave no sign. The great stone doors rumbled shut once more, sealing them within the tomb. Fourth Interlude. Have you fathomed the secret yet? The thread of folly that eventually wove our doom? There is a reason we servants of Hananja vow celibacy. There is a reason the princes were leashed. These were raindrops in a waterfall, a grain of sand flung at a storm, but we tried. True dreamers are both geniuses and madmen. Most lands can tolerate only a few, and those die young. We encouraged ours, nurtured them, kept them healthy and happy. We filled a city with them and praised our own greatness. Do you understand just how beautiful and how dangerous that was? And yes, I knew. I've told you I was a talekeeper. I have always known the answers to these questions. We train our children to keep their counsel. When I became a gatherer, I watched and would have spoken if the need had come. Fortunately, there is no need. Is there? Is there? Ah, superior, even without speaking, you are a poor liar. Will you tell my brethren, at least, that I died? Ehuru, I should have told these tales to him, not you. But he has always been fragile, despite his strength. His faith sustains him, and faith is so easy to break. So tell him I died. It will be true by the time you're done with me. And tell him that I love him. He'll need that in the time to come. And those words, I know, will be true until dreams end. Chapter 35. Speak all prayers in Sua, the tongue of the motherland, that we may remember always who we were. Speak of all dreams in our own tongue, that we may embrace who we become. Law. Amid the thrones of the dead, the Pranje begins. The first day. I'm not afraid, brother. I can help you. Stay away from me. The first night. Metal scrapes against oiled twine. What are you doing? Forgive me for waking you. I thought perhaps I could cut some of the knots holding the ironwork together. If we can get out of this cage. Silence for a moment. That was your hip strap clasp, the one your mother gave you. It was a child's thing. More scraping. Are you thirsty, brother? There's water, though no food. No. You haven't drunk since... No. After a sigh, the scraping resumes. The second day, morning, or what passes for such among the thrones of the dead. Slow, even breathing overlaid by whispered prayer. Forgive me, Hananja, I beg you. I should have offered you my tithe after the Bromarte. I know it now. Forgive my pride and selfishness. Please, please, please do not let me kill him. The second day, afternoon. A brief draft of fresh air and the fading echoes of guards' boots. At least we won't starve. Here, brother. I want nothing. Silence. A reluctant sigh. Now drink. Your mind will fight harder if your body's healthy. Have you forgotten your promise, Najiri? No, brother. Then why do you delay? You see what must be done. I see that you must eat and drink, and when our meal is done, you must pray with me. Then while you meditate, I'll resume work on those twine hinges. It may take several days, but I think... Unnatural fury splits the air. Foolish, wicked child! Do you enjoy my suffering? Will you force me to perform another of those perverted... I want anything but your suffering, brother. But if you take me, it will be a true gathering, because I offer myself willingly. Already my thoughts, the visions, I cannot. A deep breath, a struggle for calm. You gave your word, Najiri. Have you considered what will happen if I take you, brother? What? It might take longer with me, or it might go faster. I don't have your strength. But in the end, one reaper will be as good as another to the prince. Long and terrible silence. Drink, brother. When we've won our way free, and when there's no chance of either of us becoming the prince's plaything, then I will send you to her. That I vow, with everything that I am. The second night. Silence in the halls of the dead, but for the scraping. The third day, morning, harsh and shaky breath. Brother? The bars, they constrict. They will crush us. No, brother, it was a vision. I saw them. Then come sit beside me. Death is nothing to fear, is it? Over here, the bars will take less time to reach us. Come. Sandals shift on stone, slowly and reluctantly. Good. Feel my hand. I have calluses now, do you see? Camel reins, barge rowing, twine scraping. Who knew the life of a gatherer would be so hard? Gods, I should have stayed a servant caste. You. The voice is gravel. Groping for itself. You are too willful for that. You would have been forced to find a new master every other day. A rich chuckle. Too true, brother. I should be grateful at least that the Hedua doesn't beat its children. The harsh breathing stutters, then slows, calming. After a long while, thank you. No response, although a voice begins to hum a gentle, comforting hymn. It goes so fast this time, Najiri. Shh. Another shift. Now flesh strokes against flesh. Here. You're here. In this world, this body. Stay with me, brother. I need you. Yes. Yes. An audible swallow. I'd forgotten what true fear felt like. Nothing holds it back anymore. There's nothing to fear. All will be well. Rest. I'll be here when you wake. The third day, afternoon, the stir of fresh air. The stillness of the dead is broken by three new voices, peaceless and loud and disrespectful. Is he dead yet? I've got money on you, boy. Look at those eyes, Amtal. If hate could kill, you'd be dead already. No luck. The big one is breathing. He's just asleep. Sitting up? Maybe that's how they do it. Maybe he's trying to kill you from afar. Maybe he's laying a curse on your family line. Maybe he's laying a curse on your family jewels. Raucous laughter. Just feed them, you imbeciles, and let's go. I don't like this place. Stone and chains. The return of silence. After a time, the scraping begins again. The third night, early evening. You're shivering, not cold. I know. Have I ever harmed you, Nagiri? Harmed me? No, why do you ask? Of vision. It was the Pranje. I hurt you, beat you, killed. Don't be foolish, brother. I'm here, aren't I? I never sat Pranje for you, though I wanted to, trained to. And I listened to the rumors about you, talked to others who attended you. Don't worry. You've never done such a thing. A voice that trembles. In the vision, I wanted to. A voice that soothes. I will never let that happen. The third night, late, or the fourth morning, early, the small hours, the infinitesimal sounds of stealth. Death creeps on fingers and toes. Slow, even breathing catches for a moment, then resumes. Welcome, brother. Silence. Do you want me? Silence, pent. Take what you need. Use it to free yourself. I'll wait for you in Inukarek. Silence. Stealth abandoned. Now there is only breath, ragged with strain. N. Waiting. N. The voice breaks. It sounds barely human. No. I will not. I will not. Brother. No, brother, don't. Here. Yes. Yes, brother. The sobs that break the silence are without hope, but the soothing tones that overlay them are confident and loving. I wanted to. I would have. In death, I tune. Shh. She has never turned her sight from you, brother. You're her most beloved servant, and you have served her long and well. She'll welcome you when the time comes. You will dwell in her peace forever. I shall see to that myself. Now, Nagiri, it must be now. The next time you'll do whatever you must. But try to hold on, brother. I cut through the hinges a few hours ago. Now only a push will make the wall come loose. When the guards come again, we can break free. Can't hold. You can. I'll help you. Shh. Close your eyes. Yes, like that. Shh. I'll weave us a dream. Would you like that? Not a gathering, but perhaps enough to keep the madness at bay a while longer. Now lie still. Nagiri, I've always loved you, my brother. I no longer care what's right. You are my only law. Rest now, safe in my dreams. Silence. The fourth day. The prince was right, brother. Massive chains rumble, sending forth echoes as stone doors shift. Fresh air wafts through the catacombs. Amid the thrones of the dead, life gathers itself for battle. You have indeed become a weapon, but not his. All things serve Hananja's will, even this. Remember that, no matter what you do. The rumbling ceases. Footsteps violate the peaceful sanctity of Yanya Iya Inonk as the guards approach. And no matter what happens, I shall never leave your side. The guards stop before the cage's door. So, boy, is he dead yet? They laugh. And Ehiru looks up, smiling a smile that chills their souls. Yes, the Reaper says. Chapter 36. The Reaper is the abomination of all that Hananja holds dear. Do not suffer such a creature to live. Law. The first guard fell when Ehiru kicked the loosened cage wall off its hinges. The wall was heavy. It knocked one guard to the ground while the other two, caught by surprise, stood there in shock. By the time they reacted, Ehiru was out of the cage and on them. Najiri ran out after him, ready to take down whichever one Ehuru missed, but there was no need. Ehuru struck the first guard a slashing blow across the throat, and in the same blurring movement, twisted about and took hold of the second guard's face. Najiri saw the guard, screaming, blinded by Ehuru's fingers on his eyes, fumble for his sword. Najiri rushed forward to assist Ehuru, but abruptly the guard made a strangled sound and sagged to his knees. Ehuru released him. The man fell over on his side, dead. All things were Hananja's will. Najiri clung to that thought. In her name they would do whatever needed to be done. The first guard gurgled and finally died, clutching his throat. The third guard had managed to get halfway free of the entangling lattice of metal, but his leather breastplate had snagged on a spar. Ehuru, swaying in the aftermath of his reaping, turned slowly, his attention attracted by the man's struggles. Najiri crossed the room in three strides, dropped to one knee beside the struggling soldier, and broke his neck in one swift jerk. The glaze faded from Ehuru's eyes. He blinked at Najiri, lucid again for however long the guard's dream blood might last him. Sorrow flooded his face as he gazed down at Najiri's handiwork. "No more than is necessary, brother," Najiri said, standing. He wiped his hands on his foredrape. "Now come. We still need to make our way out of Yanya Eon." "Eninket." Ehuru's voice was deeper than usual, as rough and sluggish as if he'd just eaten timbaland paste. Even now, when he was newly flush with dream blood, Najiri could hear madness lurking near the surface of his lucidity. "The dream blood no longer holds it back. It keeps him alive. Nothing more. Hananja's will." Setting his jaw, Najiri replied, "He said he was going to Kaitian." Ehuru nodded and turned on his heel, heading for the door. Startled, Najiri hurried after him. The corridor beyond the catacomb's entrance was empty, for which Najiri gave private thanks. The prince must have limited the guards to three in order to minimize the chance that word of Ehuru's and Najiri's capture would get out. "Three's an unlucky number anyway," Najiri muttered to himself. They went up the steps two at a time, and then out into the brighter-lit corridors of Yanya Eon's ground floor. Servants and courtiers stumbled in passing, staring at them. Doubtless they rarely saw hollow-eyed, unwashed men in Kiswati garb sweep through the palace like a flood, Najiri thought cynically. If they raised any alarm, it was slow. So Najiri and Ehuru remained unmolested all the way to the courtyard. As they crossed the sandy expanse toward Yanya Eon's bronze gates, for a fleeting moment Najiri's mind was flung back to Hamyon night, which now seemed ages ago and a thousand dreams away. The guards on duty faced the courtyard gate, alert for unwanted intruders and unaware of the internal threat. They might have escaped relatively unscathed if someone up on one of the high tiers of the palace hadn't whistled an alarm. One of the men turned and spied Najiri and Ehuru. Startled, he jostled his fellow, both of them turning. Najiri broke into a run to close the distance, hearing Ehuru's steps speed up beside him. The first man grinned, seeing only an unarmed youth rushing toward him. Not bothering to draw his sword, he braced himself to grapple. Najiri ducked his first grab, skidded to a crouch, and drove his fist at the side of the man's knee. The wet pop of cartilage echoed through the empty courtyard. The man began to scream, dropping to the ground and holding his knee. Najiri heard another scream behind him and turned to see Ehuru, his eyes glittering with unholy fierceness, letting a corpse fall from his hands. Before it fell onto its face, Najiri saw an expression of starkest horror frozen on its features. Arrows thudded into the sand not 2 feet away. Najiri darted for the gate, grunting with effort as he raised the heavy bronze bar. Ehuru, disturbingly calm, turned to face the archers. Just as Nijiri managed to shove the bar aside and push open the gate, there was a blur of motion at the corner of his vision. When he looked around, Eiharu held an arrow in his hand. It was still quivering, 2 feet from the small of Nijiri's back. Impossible, even for the best-trained gatherer. Go, Eiharu snarled, throwing the arrow aside. Too numb to think, Nijiri scrambled through the gate. They emerged onto the busy avenue that circled Yanyi'on as more whistles sounded from the palace's heights. Through the street traffic, Nijiri saw men in the gray of the city guard turning, craning their necks to see what had caused the alarm. This way, Eiharu said. He walked swiftly into the crowd and joined its flow, keeping to the center of the street where the human river moved most swiftly. Nijiri kept his eyes low, playing servant cast again, though he darted a glance back. The guardsmen had just reached Yanyi'on's gates. A palace guard ran out with sword unsheathed, looking about wildly. They saw him gesticulating at the city men. Nijiri quickly lowered his head again, noting that Eiharu had done the same. At the first juncture of streets, they moved behind a lumbering wagon and turned south. Here was the market, where they could lose themselves easily in the sea of people. Eiharu navigated his way through the milling folk so swiftly that Nijiri was hard-pressed to keep up. Around the stitch in his side, too many days of inactivity, should have kept up my prayer dances at least, he fumbled out a hand to catch Eiharu's arm. Brother, the Hedawa is that way. No, Eiharu did not slow. Brother, we can't just walk to Kaidian. We need horses, disguises, supplies, replacements for our ornaments, and we must tell our path brothers all that has happened. Within an hour, the entire city will be on alert. Nijiri's heart sank as he realized Eiharu was right. Even worse, the sentinels at the Hedawa would be notified, as was customary in any city emergency. But the sentinels, some of them at least, obeyed the superior. Returning to the Hedawa meant recapture. Then we should take the south gate, brother, he said. Eiharu slowed and glanced back at him. Nijiri offered a rueful smile. It is not the closest gate to the moon path, I know, but the guard there is a friend of Sister Meliatua and Sunandi, remember? He may even give us a horse. Eiharu stopped, frowning as he considered this. A merchant brushed past him and he shivered, his eyes unfocusing slightly as they tracked the merchant into the crowd. His body shifted, the fingers of one hand forking at his side. Nijiri seized that hand and squeezed it hard. Eiharu flinched as if waking from a daydream, then closed his eyes in momentary anguish. The south gate, he said. Quickly, get me out of this city, Nijiri. Nijiri nodded. Keeping hold of Eiharu's hand, he pressed through the crowd in a new direction, praying that they reached Kaidian in time. Chapter 37 The world is born. Echoes, dancing fires, laughter. We race through the realm of dreams, alongside gods. The world ends. Wisdom. The prince of Gujara lay awake amid the cushions of his gauze-draped bed, contemplating the world he would one day own. He had no particular desire for conquest, but he did desire peace, like any true son of Gujara, and he had long ago realized that peace was the natural outgrowth of order. This had been proven again and again throughout the grand dream that was Gujara. The rampant crime and violence that soiled other lands was alien here. No one starved, save in the most remote backwaters. Even the lowliest servant caste had enough education and self-determination to control his own fate. Every child in the city knew his place from birth. Every elder in the city embraced his value in death. And on the strength of all who came between had Hananja's nation thrived, growing from a pathetic knot of tents perched precariously on the river mouth into a network of cities and mines and farmlands and trade routes, crowned by its capital, the glory of the civilized world, his beautiful city of dreams. But the rest of the world still struggled along in disorder, and what peace could Gujara have in the long term with such weak and petty neighbors? He had visited other lands in his youth and been horrified by chaos and cruelty that made the Shadowlands seem pleasant. Other rulers had tried to tame that chaos with might or money, sometimes succeeding, but it never lasted. How could it, when a human lifetime was only so long? Even the most noble warlord eventually grew old and died, passing on power to those who more often than not were ill-equipped to maintain it. Thus the solution: conquer the world, but for peace rather than power, and to hold the world once it was won, become a god. The prince sat up. Beside him, his first wife, Hendit, stirred. He looked down at her and stroked her cheek, greeting her sleepy smile with one of his own. After 30 years and more than 200 other wives, he still felt honored to have her favor. In the way of southern women, she was still beautiful, even with her youth long past. Time had left few seams in her dark, smooth skin. But she was old, past 50, nearly as old as himself. He yearned for more children from her, and perhaps could have had them if he'd permitted her to accept Dreamblood from the Hedwa. But tempting as the notion had been, he could not bear the thought of the Hedwa setting its claws into yet another member of his family. He kissed her forehead. "I would still rather you stay here. It will be dangerous." She lifted a hand to trace his lips with one finger. "Don't be foolish." He smiled and nodded, approving of her decision, despite the flicker of grief that moved through him. He would lose her when the power made him immortal. Another decade or two, and then she would pass beyond his reach into Ina Karek, where he would never see her again. More sorrow to lay at the Hedwa's feet, he decided. Then he rose, naked, to begin his war. Servants draped a feather robe over him for the walk to the baths. There they sluiced his skin with purifying salt and lemon water, and dabbed him dry with oiled rose petals. When they finished dressing him in the armor of his ancestors and threading gold into his hair, he left the apartments to find Hendit and their son Wanahoman waiting for him. From his kneeling posture, Wana lifted a sword in a worked leather sheath. When the prince took it, Wana raised his eyes to watch him belt it on, and not for the first time did the prince marvel at the stark worship in his son's gaze. "So be it," he thought. "Let Hananja and the moon's children have the land of dreams. The waking world belonged to the sons of the sun." "Come," he said, and Wanahoman rose, immediately falling into place, one pace behind and to the right as they walked. Ever proper, Hendit followed on his left, her head high in anticipation and pride. As they entered the public corridors, his aureole servant leaped up to follow in his wake. The prince considered waving the child away, but decided it would be more fitting to discard the aureole afterward, when he had become a god and more than name. Sharis fell in behind them, and thus they proceeded to the steps that led up Kaidion's highest tower. Around them the marble corridors were empty. For their own protection the prince had sent all his other wives and children away, and stationed the sunset guard on the lowest floor of the palace to protect against attack. Only these four, an auspicious and pleasing number, would witness his ascension. They mounted the steps in silence, passing the landing where Nias had faced his final moments, not stopping until they reached the topmost level of the spire. As Sharis opened the door, a finger of light pierced the faraway horizon and spread as the sun's golden curve made its first appearance. The prince smiled. Far to the south, where the desert met the Kisawati border, the coming of dawn had signaled his army's attack. He stepped out onto the balcony, inhaling in pleasure as a brisk wind rose from the ground far below, lifting his hair like curling wings. To one side of the balcony a figure stirred, the rattle of chains breaking the morning silence. The prince glanced over at his reaper, which crouched where the servants had chained it against the wall. The servants' corpses lay at its feet. The prince was amused to see that some flicker of its old self must have stirred in the reaper during the night. It had arranged the bodies in dignified positions. The Jungisa stone that the prince raised was crude, ugly. It had chipped off a larger piece of sun seed. The peculiar stones that fell every now and then from the sky, and unlike the artfully carved jewels used by the Hedewa, this one was just a chunk of rock. Still, when the prince struck it against a nearby railing, the reaper shivered, lifting its head.
Brother?
The prince raised his eyebrows in surprise. The reaper rarely spoke these days. The remnants of its personality had grown so weak that he barely needed the Jungisa anymore. His will was enough to hold the creature's thoughts. Putting the stone away, he went over to it, crouching to peer into its confused eyes. "Here. Did you rest well, Unaune?" The reaper blinked against the sunlight, sighing and shaking its head.
"No. Visions. There was pain. Eohru, he suffered."
The prince nodded to Sharis, who unlocked the chain fastened to the collar round the reaper's neck. "Yes, Path Brother," the prince said, taking the end of the chain from Sharis. He reached up to stroke the creature's slack cheek. "Unfortunately, he suffers. But now the time has come for your own suffering to end. One last task, one last glorious gathering, and then you may rest." Longing flooded the creature's eyes. Tears welled in its eyes.
"Yes, yes, oh please, brother, I have served for so long."
"I know, just a little longer, and then her peace awaits you, I promise. Come." He stood, tugging the reaper's leash. It rose and flowed after him, predator, graceful, even with its mind all but gone. He stopped at the railing, gesturing Hendit and the rest of them back. But then, suddenly, the reaper stiffened. It whipped about to face the balcony doorway, nearly pulling the chain from the prince's hand. He caught his breath and gripped the leash, preparing to set his will against the thing's mad hunger, but then realized the creature's attention had not fixed on Hendit or Wanahomin. He followed the reaper's gaze and set his jaw.
"Enough, Aninket," snarled Eohru.
Chapter 38. There is nothing to fear in nightmares, so long as you control them. Wisdom. Like a vision, the dreamer had raced across the nighttime sky as their horses blurred along the moon path to Kaitian. Through the rushing wind, the only constants Eohru had grasped were anger and Najiri's voice, penetrating the blur now and again to remind him of who he was. They entered Kaitian's welcome hall and found it full of soldiers. With his mother's voice echoing in his mind, Eohru hated them, and so fierce was his hatred that some of it broke free and leaped forth. When he pulled it back, their souls came with it, plump, wriggling fish snared in the net of his mind. He'd devoured them greedily, savoring their pain and terror as a piquant spice, and guilt soured the moment only a little. Now he stood facing his prince, his brother, his betrayer, and the hatred returned. But this time he held it back. He would cleanse this corruption from Gujara's soul in the proper manner he had decided along the way, as a gatherer and not a monster. For justice and for Hananja, he would be himself one last time. "Enough," he said again, stalking onto the balcony. Najiri flowed behind him, a shadow ready to strike. To one side, a woman, two men, and a servant child stood in shock, their souls bright, alluring flames that called out to him. He ignored them,
and the hunger that wanted them.
Yield. I still have enough control to give you peace. If you resist, I can promise nothing.
Aninket gave him a cool smile, though Ehuru saw anger lurking underneath.
Don't be foolish, Ehuru. Death or godhood, which would you choose?
He put his hand on the Reaper's shoulder, and the creature uttered a feral hiss at them.
Control your beast, Aninket.
Ehuru raised his voice. It was not the peaceful thing to do, but there was little peace left inside him, and he did not care besides.
The man it once was could have beaten me, but not this sorry thing. And if you unleash it, it may attack indiscriminately.
He glanced at their inadvertent audience. The man in the garb of a high-ranking soldier drew his sword. The youth did the same. The youth's features bore an Inket stamp Ehuru had already noted, and that of the Shunha woman who stood with him. He saw, too, the fear that flashed across an Inket's face. Keeping a hand on the Reaper's shoulder, an Inket spoke softly but firmly.
Wanahoman, leave with your mother. Sharis, protect them with your life.
The man looked ready to argue, though he threw an uneasy glance at the Reaper, which had fixed its gaze on Najiri in blatant eagerness, and subsided. The youth had no such qualms.
Father, I will not.
Do as I say.
Aninket tore his eyes away from Ehuru long enough to glare the youth into submission.
Now go.
After another moment, the youth slumped, and the woman pulled him toward the door by the arm. The soldier grabbed the arm of the child, who clutched a pole bearing the aureole, and dragged him out as well. Once Ehuru heard their footsteps moving away down the stairs, he stepped closer, keeping a wary eye on the Reaper.
You've lost, Ehuru said to Aninket. Face your death with dignity.
Even now, after everything I've told you,
Aninket uttered a soft, bitter laugh.
A slave of the Hetawa to the end.
No, Ehuru. I'm not the one who's lost here, he sighed.
So be it.
As he gazed down the Reaper, Aninket's face took on a peculiar look of concentration. The Reaper froze, expression going even more slack than usual, though it cocked its head as if listening. Then Aninket took his hand away from its shoulder. Even with that warning, the creature's speed caught Ehuru by surprise. He had only an instant to brace himself, but it flashed past him, and suddenly he realized that he was not its target.
Najiri!
But the boy caught the Reaper's hand before it could reach his face, twisting to turn aside its momentum. The creature stumbled off balance, and Najiri struck it in the middle of its sunken chest. It fell to the ground, flailing, and Najiri closed in, his eyes more vicious than Ehuru had ever seen. Ehuru moved to assist, but abruptly a faint sound from behind impinged on his awareness. He whirled to face whatever trickery Aninket was attempting, and froze, staring at the humming Jungisa stone in his brother's hand. Aninket tensed, then paused, narrowing eyes at him.
Come here, Ehuru, said Aninket.
Ehuru took a step toward Aninket, before it occurred to him to wonder why he did so. He stopped, frowning.
So it works on you as well, Aninket stared at him with something akin to wonder.
The superior said you had been deprived, and yet the boy is alive. Who, then, have you killed to preserve your own life, my brother?
As Ehuru set his jaw against shame, Aninket smiled, relaxing, a high gleam of victory in his eyes.
You're as corrupt as the rest of them, for all your pious talk.
The Jungisa song filled Ehuru's mind, throwing him back to 1,000 nights and 1,000 gatherings, making him yearn for the time when things had been so simple in his life, when he had been pure, and there had been nothing but peace in his heart, and...
What is this?
In confusion, he shook his head, but the stone's whine pierced through his thoughts like a dagger.
Another secret of the scrolls, said Aninket, drawing near. A reaper's mind grows in sensitivity as well as power, leaving you vulnerable to the simplest narcomancy.
Ehru struggled to draw his eyes away from the Jungisa as it grew in his vision, but he failed. The sound of the thing drowned out everything else, including the sounds of Najiri's struggle against the reaper behind him. He tried again to focus on Aninket, who was now unprotected and could be gathered, but...
Ananja's favorite, they call you. The most skilled gatherer in recent memory. The dying dream of being taken by you. Yet look at the price you've paid for serving the Hedawa so well, Ehru. You've become mine even faster than Unaune. The prince sighed. Perhaps this was always meant to be, my brother. Now come.
The word drove into Ehru, backed by a will that parted his own like bed hangings, and touched the most secret part of his consciousness where it lay. On some level he thought he made a sound, perhaps a strangled groan. He could not be sure. A hand touched his shoulder. He shivered beneath it, trying to let the hate loose again, but the mind that had woven its way into his gently pushed those thoughts aside.
Come, brother, Aninket said again.
Ehru turned and walked where the voice steered him, over to the balcony railing. Behind him, from a distance, he heard someone cry his name, Najiri. Fear for the boy nearly gave him the strength to turn back, but Aninket's will beat against his own.
Shh, brother.
Now he was lost again, in the cage under Yanya Eon, weeping against the hunger that had nearly driven him to murder Najiri. The voice was different, but the words of comfort were the same, the hands on his shoulders almost as tender.
It's all right, said the voice in his ear, twisting his memories further.
Najiri? No. There was no love in this voice.
I understand. So much corruption all around. So much suffering. And you helpless to stop it. But I can help you, brother.
With a supreme effort, Ehru managed to close his eyes. But this was a mistake. The whine of the Jungisa followed him into the darkness, and the voice spread its roots farther into his mind.
Now, reach out, brother. Distance should be no barrier to you. Reach out, across the desert. Do you feel them?
With his eyes shut, Ehru had nothing to focus on but the voice. He fought it, but his mind stretched forth anyhow, falling away from him as though down a slanting pit. Visions formed around him, the desert flying on Skyrer's wings. There was the village of Ketuye, there the oasis at Tessa. There were the foothills, and suddenly his descent changed. Something pulled him aside. He frowned, slowing, tasting blood and pain and nightmare, a thick fear on the air. And death. Where there was death, there was dream blood.
Corruption, brother. Do you feel it? Filth, the likes of which our land has not seen in centuries.
Ehru felt it. He whimpered as terror, cruelty, rage beat against his senses, driving thought even further beneath the surface of his mind. He could see them now. Hundreds, thousands, men with swords and bloodlust, intent on hacking one another to pieces, the antithesis of peace. Then the vision changed, and he saw only light where they had been, sparks that flared and then faded in death, others that burned steadily, together merging into a flickering whole, a sun whose warmth promised to fill the cold and aching emptiness within him. So many souls, so very many. On another plane, Ehru licked his lips.
They will come here, Ehru. Infect us with their savagery and chaos. Destroy our peace, her peace, forever.
The voice moved closer to his ear,
whispering its warning over distant screams of pain and rage and his own ravening lust. Stop them, little brother. Take them. Take them all now and share them with me.
There was nothing left in him that could fight. The magic and the hunger had consumed it all. Stretching out his hands and mind, Ehuru took hold of over 20,000 lives and began to reap.
Chapter 39. By the age of 8 floods, a Gujarin child should be able to read law and recite the first 4 tenets of wisdom, multiply and divide by 4s and 10s, and wield his soul name for protection in dreams. Wisdom. The sight of waking moon had been a comfort to Sanandi throughout her childhood. The hours of the dreamer belonged to those who ruled Kiswa's streets. That was the time of slavers and whoremasters, muggers and gangs, the strong who devoured the weak. But the setting of the dreamer marked the end of their time, for by then the worst of the predators would have hunted, fed, and returned to their lairs to dream cold, bloody dreams. After that, only waking moon hung in the sky. The shy, plain sister of the Heavenly Queen, who had the heavens to herself for only an hour or so before the sun returned, less in the rainy season. But while waking moon's pallid light shone over the city streets, the weak had their time. The child called Nefe, and her fellows at the bottom of the hierarchy, could creep forth from their hiding places then, to nibble on the leavings of their betters. And if there was no food to eat, and nothing of value to steal, at least there was safety, and with safety had come the few moments of happiness she recalled in that early life. Playing, laughing, feeling for that one hour like a child. She would never regret being adopted by Kinja, but neither had she ever forgotten those times, as dear to her as the mother she barely remembered. Tonight, the waking moon's light gave her no comfort, for beneath it she could see the armies of Gujara, covering the plateau of Soijaro like a leper's sores. Too late, priest. We have failed, both my corrupt ways and your mad, rigid justice, and now both our lands will drown in blood. Sanandi's horse moved restlessly beneath her, perhaps reacting to the scent of fear in the air. She controlled the animal with a clumsy tug on the reins, and only then realized that Anzi Sei Anunu had come up beside her, accompanied by Maweke J. Chi, chief wise woman of the protectors. Anzi, the general of the Kisawati forces, was a tall, hard sword of a man, brutally straightforward in speech and action. Maweke was a sharp contrast to him, a plump, self-possessed elder, radiant with quiet power. The storytellers in the capital said she was a mystic whose dreams often came true. Rumor also had it that she was not fully Kiswati, which would be a great scandal if true, though no one had managed to prove it yet. Sanandi wondered if she was part Gujarin. The final attempt at parley has failed, Maweke said, reining in her horse beside Sunandi's. She spoke softly, though all the camp was awake and restless with the coming battle. Our rider was given an arrow through the gut for his trouble. Sunandi drew her robes closer about herself, chilled by more than the cool night air. We knew a truce was unlikely, esteemed. But you hoped. The old woman smiled at Sunandi's expression. You have been waiting for your priest friend to stop this somehow. Sunandi opened her mouth to tell Maweke that gatherer Ehuru was in no way her friend, but then closed it. It no longer mattered. If he had failed, then he was dead. I must go, Anzi said. His voice was deep, surprisingly gentle for that of a soldier, perversely reminding her of Ehuru. The enemy waits only for dawn. Maweke nodded to give him leave, but the general did not urge his horse away for a moment.
"There's a wrongness in this," he said abruptly, looking out over the plateau. His forehead, Sunandi saw, was deeply lined in a frown.
"The enemy's plan is flawed. They'll all die."
Sunandi frowned, trying to fathom how he had concluded this by looking at the army massing below. In the distance, she could make out a line of masts along the coast. These were the mysterious ships whose existence Kinja and probably Nias had died to reveal. Their deaths had not been in vain, for between those warnings and the Protector's own suspicions, Kisua was ready to meet the Gujarin attack just. Anzi had managed to assemble 12,000 soldiers, who surrounded the plateau and filled the valley beyond it, the only logical path the invaders could take to reach the Kisuwati capital. But although Sunandi was no expert in the strategies of war, she could see no reason for Anzi's confidence. 12,000 soldiers, many of them exhausted from being force-marched across half of Kisua to reach the plateau in time, were by no means a sure victory against 10,000 warriors who were fresh and chafing for battle. "We have enough to hold them," Anzi said, as if reading Sunandi's mind. "And this is our land. We have ambushes set throughout the valley and the surrounding mountains. Our supply lines are reliable. We can keep them here days, even weeks if we must, long enough for our troops on the way from the south to arrive. It will be a war of attrition, which they will inevitably lose. Their commander is a fool if he doesn't see this."
Moweke watched him for a moment. "Perhaps they, too, have reinforcements on the way."
"Perhaps. Likely, in fact. But this is still wrong," Anzi said. Sunandi winced at his disrespect, but Moweke merely sighed. Perhaps the protectors were used to him.
"This was foolish from the outset. If they meant to win, they should have arrived with twice this number, if not more."
"What are you saying, General?" Sunandi said. "That they have no desire to win?" She could almost smell the Gujarin troops' hatred. Many of them were northerners, the scouts had reported. Barbarians who scorned all civilized folk as soft and decadent cowards. They were hungry for the chance to reap the riches of Kisua.
"I have no idea," he said. "You know these foreign madmen better than I. But if they've come to die on our shores, then I shall be happy to oblige them."
He gave Sunandi and Moweke a curt nod, then wheeled his horse away. They saw him start down the trail that led from their encampment on the heights into the valley. From there, he would lead the battle. Which would be very soon now, Sunandi saw. The sky in the east had grown visibly paler in the past few moments. "We should break camp, esteemed," she said to Moweke. "Negotiation is no longer possible. We must return to the capital, where you and the other protectors can be properly defended." Moweke nodded, but did not move.
"Anzi is correct," she said. "There must be something more to this. The Prince of Gujara is no fool. He has a maze of a mind."
Sunandi had never heard a more fitting metaphor, but they had more pressing matters at the moment. "We can do nothing but deal with the problem on our doorstep, esteemed."
"No. We can make our own plans to foil the prince, and have done. The relief troops from the south will not come here. The other protectors and I have chosen to send them north."
Sunandi frowned in confusion. "I don't understand, esteemed. There's nothing north but the empty thousand, and—" The realization came almost at once. She trailed off. Moweke read her face and nodded in cool approval. "There can be no reason for the prince to have built a garrison in the desert," the elder said, "other than to support an invasion by land. A second invasion. The protectors believe this," she gestured out at the Gujarin army gathered on Soijaro, "to be merely a diversion. So we will deal with the true threat at its source." Sunandi swallowed hard. "The general may have need of those troops, esteemed. At the very least, he should know to expect no relief. It is problematic to ask a soldier to risk his life for no good reason," Moweke said. "He doesn't fight as hard, thinking it hopeless. He welcomes death too quickly, thinking of the glory in sacrifice. We must have Anzi's full commitment, for this is our distraction as well. Kiswa has defenses enough to deal with this rabble should we lose the battle. But we shall win the war. When our relief troops are done with the desert garrison, they have orders to continue even further north, to Gujara's capital. Struck dumb by pure horrified astonishment, Sanandi stared at her. So it must be, Muweke said. Her voice was soft, almost lost in the early morning breeze, but implacable. Gujara is a daughter gone wayward and spoiled, and now we must take her in hand. The correction will be painful for both our lands, but in the end, all will be better. She glanced over at Sunandi, contemplative. You've done very well through all this, Jay Kalawe. Better than expected, given your youth. Learn from these events. They may make you a formidable protector some day. With that, Muweke turned her horse and rode away, back to where a party of soldiers and slaves were packing their encampment to leave. Sunandi gazed after her, too numb to follow. Inadvertently, she visualized a pitched battle at the gates of Gujara. The image of pale walls splashed red filled her with sudden nausea. She had always hated Gujara, and yet... Behind Sunandi, dawn broke. Below, on the plateau, the battle began. Sunandi closed her eyes against the massed battle cry of 22,000 men. Silently, for the first time in her life, she prayed to Hananja. Stop this. Only you can, at this point. Make the prince see reason. Save your city, and both our lands, from more pointless, useless death. For a long moment, as she had expected, there was no answer. Then the back of her neck prickled, reacting to a presence. Startled, she turned in her saddle. Eheru stood behind her horse, his shoulders slumped, his eyes on the ground. Sunandi caught her breath, more glad than she could ever have imagined to see him alive, but... He lifted his head, and Sunandi recoiled, shocked by what looked at her through his eyes. Insanity. Naked and glittering. So alien to his face that she barely recognized him. Insanity and something more. Hunger. Distantly, through the sudden pounding of her heart in her ears, Sunandi registered that the sounds of the battle below had faltered to a halt. They all see him, she realized, though she could not have said how she knew. Every soldier, official and slave on the Soijaro Plateau shared this vision. Then Eheru reached for her with arms grown impossibly long, his lips stretching in a ragged smile to reveal teeth sharp as rose thorns. I bring you peace, he whispered, his fingers burrowing into her skin like roots. In the world of flesh and blood, Sunandi went rigid on her horse and began to scream. 22,000 other throats screamed with her, but that world was meaningless. The dream world was the Reaper's domain, the only world that mattered, and in that realm, Eheru dragged Sunandi to the ground, pinning her effortlessly. He crouched over her, still smiling his loving smile, and hunkered down to feed. Chapter 40 A gatherer who refuses the final tithe shall be deemed corrupt. Law. Die at last, Najiri thought fiercely. And if you fall into the Shadowlands, I do not care. He kicked Unaune over onto his back, and then straddled him, taking hold of his chin and the back of his head. But he had forgotten the Reaper's speed. Unaune's fist struck him under the chin, the force of the blow nearly breaking his neck. Stunned, Najiri swayed back. Unaune heaved underneath him, and flung him to the balcony floor. An instant later, Najiri found their positions reversed, Unaune's head blotting out the dawn sky above him,
Amber streaks of the rising sun illuminated Una Une's gaunt face and one eye, which glittered with malevolent glee.